This is SciPod, the podcast of New Scientist magazine.
Welcome to SciPod, your audio guide to the most intriguing stories in science and technology, as gathered and reported by the staff of New Scientist magazine. Hello, I'm Bill Oxley. This week on the April 21st edition of SciPod, the many histories of time. What happens when Stephen Hawking and string theory get together? It's a whole new way of looking at the universe. Wild Britain. No, it's not the new sound from London's club scene. It's a noctual bat, and it's coming to an iPod near you. And the secret power of wallaby milk. It's just one of the refreshing stories on offer in this week's science news. But first, as universes go, our universe may strike you as a pretty reasonable place. But if you're a theoretical cosmologist, it's anything but. For years, some of the world's brainiest researchers have been trying to understand how the laws of physics led to the universe we live in, and why it became this particular universe and not one that makes our existence impossible. Now, one of the giants of cosmology has weighed in on the question. Stephen Hawking has produced a new paper that takes a very different approach to explaining the universe around us. Thomas Hertog is a longtime collaborator and co-author of the new paper. This week, he spoke with New Scientist Ivan Semenek.
Dr. Hertog, I know there are lots of questions about the universe that cosmologists find puzzling. For example, there's the flatness problem, which tells us that the universe is expanding neither too fast nor too slow, but just right for us. Can you tell me what you and Stephen Hawking find unsatisfactory about the way these questions are being addressed by cosmology today?
Well, those questions have not really been addressed because people have been asking those questions in a very classical way, by which I mean based on classical physics. But Penrose and Hawking in the 70s have shown that that classical physics breaks down near the Big Bang, and that we really need to take a quantum approach in order to describe the origin of the universe, and therefore in order to put cosmology on a fundamentally predictive footing. And so far, for instance, with regard to the flatness problem, if you ask that question in a classical way, then you would just impose very specific initial conditions at the Big Bang and then let them evolve in order to get a flat universe today. But you can't ask the question of why are those initial conditions chosen, and that's precisely the issue that we want to address.
Now, you were saying that even as far back as the 70s, Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose were talking about how the universe has to be treated as a quantum event. I think most of us are used to thinking of quantum mechanics as a branch of physics that applies to things on a much smaller scale, in fact, the subatomic scale. So how do you go about applying quantum mechanics to the entire universe as a whole?
The argument that quantum mechanics applies to the entire universe follows, of course, from the singularity theorems, namely the fact that classical physics breaks down near the Big Bang. The real lesson of those theorems is that the origin of the universe was a quantum event. But of course it poses a major problem, because we have no control over the initial state, or we do not know the initial state of the universe. So in order to apply quantum mechanics to the entire universe, that is a quite different setup from the one we have in laboratories. And furthermore, we can certainly not hope to observe many copies of the universe. So that is the main issue that needs to be addressed in quantum cosmology. The way you do that is by taking into account all possible universes that contribute to the universe, to the path integral for the universe as we observe it. In other words, all histories that end up as a universe like the one we see.
I see. So in the same way that a quantum physicist might sum up all the possible pathways that a particle might take as it's moving through space, you're considering the current universe as a sort of final state, and then summing up all the possible beginnings that might lead to that final state.
Right.
And I guess if you're going to take that a step further than things were in the 70s, you have to resort to more than just traditional quantum theory. Your new paper also involves applying string theory to the universe as a whole. Can you explain what the goal of that work is?
There are two parts to our work. One is, of course, developing the general framework for cosmology within the string landscape. And another part, second part then, is applying that framework to derive specific predictions. So in order to extend the list of specific predictions that our framework makes, we need to have, of course, we need to get a better handle on the string theory landscape itself.
And what do you gain by applying string theory in this way?
Well, string theory should give us a fundamental microscopic description of reality, and therefore it puts certain constraints on what are the possible histories of the universe. String theory provides a set of laws which all histories have to obey. So it's really our framework is a our framework that we propose does not go without string theory. It's really a combination of input from string theory and input from quantum cosmology.
Now, in quantum mechanics, the observer has a very important role. The observer, in a sense, kind of shapes the way a system can unfold. So what is the role of the observer, then, in this formulation that you and Stephen Hawking have created of our universe?
Yeah, so that's what I alluded to earlier. When you sum over, when you take into account all these histories of the universe, it is the observer, or more generally, features of the current state of our universe, which act as a selection principle on that set of histories. All histories that do not obey certain features we observe today are clearly excluded from those that are relevant.
So does that mean, to some extent, we are selecting our own universe, or that we are somehow, as observers in the universe, shaping its history?
From an outside point of view, this would indeed be precisely what's happening. But of course, really what we're doing as observers inside the universe is trying to figure out which history of all possible histories in the string landscape is actually realized in the universe we observe.
Now, it seems to me this is a really elegant way of addressing one of the more uncomfortable ideas in cosmology, namely that in order to explain how our universe came by all these properties that seem so finely tuned for life, it's necessary to imagine that all possible universes exist in parallel, and we just happen to live in this one. But it looks like what you're saying is that you don't really need all those other universes. Just as they do in quantum mechanics, all those possibilities somehow interfere with each other and cancel out to leave us just what the one real universe within which we exist.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you've described it very well. I have little to add to that.
Okay, so in that case then, how does your formulation account for the fact that the one universe we ended up with can support intelligent life? This is the anthropic principle. If there are no other universes, why do we have these conditions which are so ideal?
Well, we do not have other universes which are actually realized, but we do, of course, have in our quantum framework this multiplicity of potential universes, right? And so it's to which we apply certain selection effects. So it may turn out that some of the conditions, some of the observations that we have to use could be interpreted as essentially entropy conditions. For instance, the fact that we live in three dimensions. There seems to be nothing that prefers three dimensions in string theory above another over another number of dimensions. But arguments have been advanced that this is essentially tied to the existence of life, that that's particularly easier in three dimensions than other dimensions. So if that's a condition which we end up using in order to in the top-down approach, then that could be interpreted as an entropic condition. So what I would say is that our framework has the potential of making a precise, putting the entropic principle within a well-defined theoretical framework, and by doing so, making it precise.
Well, it certainly is a very provocative way of thinking about the universe. It's sort of a top-down approach rather than the traditional bottom-up approach we started this conversation talking about. Just before we go, Dr. Hertog, of course, your collaborator on this paper is Stephen Hawking, who's well known for his unconventional approaches to cosmology and often for breaking new ground in taking such approaches. I wonder if you can comment on the experience of working with Stephen Hawking and how that's affected your perspective as a cosmologist.
Well, that's an interesting question because I was shaped as a cosmologist, of course, during my PhD. I worked with Hawking, so this is not the first time we've worked together. But still, it strikes me that we've discussed the current paper, which we are talking about, so the top-down approach. We've discussed that subject for many, many years, 5 or 6 years, I think. And only now our ideas and our thoughts about it really came together and materialized in this work. So even though Stephen has a tendency of being very creative and taking a very original point of view, it took us many years to really take that no-boundary theory to its logical, fully quantum conclusion. So this suggests to me that the union between string theory and cosmology, which we try to sort of initiate with our paper, is really only about to start. We still haven't grasped, in my opinion, the consequences of quantum mechanics when we apply it to the entire universe.
Well, in that case, we appreciate you getting us in on the ground floor, or maybe I should say the top floor, of the string theory cosmology connection. Thanks very much for speaking with us, Dr. Hertog.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thomas Hertog spoke to us from his office at the Collège de France in Paris. You can find out more about the new cosmological framework he and Stephen Hawking are working on by peering into this week's issue of New Scientist magazine. And unlike the rest of the universe, there's no strings attached.
Because you're curious about the latest in science and technology news, we bring you SciPod.
Now from the London office of New Scientist, here's Caroline Williams with this week's science news.
Have you been losing sleep over fears that a gamma ray burst will one day wipe out life on Earth? Well, rest easy. According to a new study, that possibility is much less likely than astronomers once thought. A gamma ray burst is a catastrophic outpouring of energy that signals the death of a massive star. Scientists predict that a gamma ray burst exploding within 6,500 light-years of Earth would produce enough radiation to strip away the ozone layer and cause a mass extinction. Because the stars that trigger them are rare, gamma ray bursts have so far only been seen at great distances, erupting in galaxies far beyond our own Milky Way. The new study, which comes out of Ohio State University, finds that those galaxies are different from our own because they contain stars that are relatively poor in elements heavier than hydrogen and helium. Some theories suggest those elements affect the way a star explodes and can prevent it from becoming a fully fledged gamma ray burst. Because the Milky Way is full of stars containing heavy elements, it could mean gamma ray bursts just don't happen in our galaxy. All of which means that we have one less disaster to worry about. Researchers in Australia have discovered a new weapon in the fight against antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Wallaby milk. Like other marsupials, a newborn tamar wallaby is barely more than a fetus. It has a heart but no lungs and spends all of its time in its mother's pouch. Because it also lacks a developed immune system, the baby wallaby relies on compounds in its mother's milk to protect it against pathogens. The Australian team found that wallaby milk contains a protein that's 100 times more effective against some strains of bacteria than the most potent form of penicillin. A comparison of the wallaby and human genome suggests that the ability to produce the protein was lost when placental mammals split off from marsupials, roughly 100 million years ago. He was called Alexander the Great, and he did conquer most of the ancient world, but according to a team of French archaeologists, the Macedonian ruler doesn't deserve credit for at least one of his legendary deeds, the founding of Alexandria. The team measured lead variations in a mud core extracted from the site of Alexandria's ancient harbour. By carbon dating seashells found throughout the core, they were able to piece together how lead levels have changed over time. Lead is associated with activities such as plumbing and shipbuilding. The team's findings suggest that these things were going on at the site of Alexandria long before Alexander himself arrived, around 330 BC. However, they also show that lead levels increased dramatically at this time, suggesting there was a period of urban growth in a previously established port. So, even if the ancient warrior wasn't quite as great as he's made out to be, he at least earned the right to be called Alexander the Pretty Good.
We hope you're enjoying this week's edition of SciPod, and we'd love to know what you think of our podcast. If you've got a comment or suggestion, please drop us a line. Just email your feedback to podcast@newscientist.com. And now, back to our show.
You're listening to the sound of a field cricket. It is a species of insect that is so rare in Britain that today it's only found in 3 farm fields in southern England. And scientists are now trying to reintroduce the species from continental Europe. That sound, and thousands more like it, come from the British Library Sound Archive. And this week, the library is releasing a new CD called Vanishing Wildlife that showcases the sound of some of Britain's most elusive insects, birds, mammals, and frogs. Richard Ramft is head of technical sciences for the Sound Archive, and this week he's agreed to share with us some of his favorite sounds from the collection.
Hi, Richard.
Hello.
Richard, before we start our audio tour, I was hoping you could tell us more about the British Library Sound Archive, and in particular all the nature sounds in your collection. It's quite a large collection, isn't it?
It is a large collection. The Nature Sounds collection has about 150,000 individual recordings. People might be surprised, in fact, that the British Library has any sounds at all, let alone nature sounds, but in fact the library has a lot of different kinds of materials, obviously books and manuscripts, maps, but also recorded sounds.
And when did the library start collecting nature sounds?
The Nature Sounds collection dates back to 1969, when a couple of scientists said we really need reference collections of sounds, just as we need reference collections of skins of animals in nature museums. We now need sounds as reference for the purpose of classification or studying animal behavior. So it began life as a scientific collection. So all the sounds here are documented. They're sort of labeled, in effect, with details of where and when they were made and so on. And they'd be contributed by amateur sound recordists and professional ornithologists or professional biologists over many years. In fact, something like 500 donors have made recordings over the years.
So now you've put together this compilation CD called Vanishing Wildlife. What's the story behind this project?
The British Library wants to make its collections more widely available, and this is one very effective way of doing so. We've selected just 31 tracks on this CD from the many thousands in the collection here, so partly to make them more widely available, but they work on different levels. The sounds are intriguing in their own right. They're enjoyable to listen to. They bring back people's memories of their visits to the countryside, some of the wildest places around Britain. But it's also, more seriously, it's an important tool for conservationists who want to study and locate the species that are featured on the CD.
Okay, well, let's get started. You've picked out a few sounds for us. Here comes the first one. Let's listen for a bit, and then you can tell us what it is we're listening to.
Well, this first sound is the song of a male capercaillie.
It's not what I expected. It sounded almost mechanical. What is it we're hearing exactly?
Well, the capercaillie is a large game bird. It's like a large grouse, or some people think it looks like a turkey. It's a very impressive bird, and it occurs in the upland conifer areas in Scotland. It also occurs in other parts of Europe, but it's confined in Britain to just one part of Scotland. And in the breeding season, the males congregate together in social groups called leks, and they perform this extraordinary display. And what you hear on the recording is this bizarre sound. It sounds rather like someone emptying wine from a wine bottle. strange popping noises, followed by a sound that people have likened to knives being ground together. So birds can certainly make extraordinary noises. This bird is actually using these sounds in order to impress rival males who are competing for the females who stand next to the group of male birds while they're displaying and select the most impressive mate. And you also hear the sounds of wing bashing. These birds can get quite aggressive and will make loud wing sounds and occasionally sort of attack each other. They'll even actually go after the odd human who happens to get too near, although, of course, being protected birds, you shouldn't really get near these birds anyway.
Well, I don't know if any other capercaillie was impressed by that, but I'm impressed. Now, Richard, here's our second sound. What can you tell us about this one?
Sound of pool frogs. These are amphibians that have unfortunately become extinct in Britain. They occurred in Norfolk, in the sort of eastern part of England, and this recording was made 20 years ago. At the time, everyone thought this was the sound of another frog, an introduced frog, a frog artificially brought into Britain called the edible frog. And so it was rather overlooked because these are common in France and continental Europe. However, experts started to look at Anglo-Saxon sites, about 1,000-year-old sites, and found bones of the pool frog. And so scientists came into the British Library and said, we're very interested to listen to your recordings of frogs, including edible frogs, particularly from Norfolk, and lo and behold, they listened to this sound and were immediately struck by the fact that these sounds had been mislabeled. They'd been misidentified at the time, and they turned out to be pool frogs. However, by the time they heard these sounds, the pool frog had already gone extinct.
Well, that certainly falls into the category of vanishing wildlife, which I guess makes all of these recordings so much more poignant. We've got one more to listen to, and here it comes now.
Extraordinary sound is made by a bat. Now, many bats, as people know, catch insects, and they also use sonar, a kind of echo sounder, in order to find their way in the dark. And this is what you're hearing in the recording. The bat is in effect shouting at incredibly loud volume, but it's so high-pitched that we can't hear it. And on the recording, the sound has been transposed down by several octaves to make it audible so we can hear it. So this is the sound of a noctual bat. This is a bat that likes to roost in trees in Britain. And unfortunately, it roosts in natural hollows. A lot of people tend to remove dead trees and dead wood, and so its roosting sites are diminishing. Furthermore, it's an insectivorous bat, and due to agricultural change, intensive agriculture, there are fewer flying insects around. So this bat's being punished really on two sides. It's losing its home and losing its food supply.
These are all very good examples, I think, of the diversity of wildlife in Britain, and of course it gives one an appreciation for exactly what's being lost. I think it also creates some appreciation for what it took to build up this audio legacy. I can imagine there must be some remarkable stories from the people that went out to acquire these sounds.
There are indeed incredible stories about how these recordings were obtained. It requires almost fanatical dedication on behalf of the field recordists because these sounds, of course, the animals are rare to start with, but actually trying to get them on a tape or disc is a real feat in itself. In this country, for example, there's an organization called the Wildlife Sound Recording Society, made up of about 300 members, and these people, for a hobby, try and collect sounds, and there's nothing more challenging than trying to collect some of the rarer sounds, but it needs a lot of patience, a lot of luck, the weather's got to be right, and the animals got to cooperate. So it's a tall order getting these sounds indeed.
What are you hoping will be the impact of this CD?
Well, there's been a lot of interest already in the CD. We hope conservationists will find it a very useful tool for them to home in on the particular sounds, sounds of animals that are becoming very rare, and we need to monitor their numbers and try and do something to preserve their habitats. But it also brings greater awareness to people who aren't directly involved in conservation. They'll be their awareness of the plight of these animals will be raised. They'll be able to lobby their local organizations that have influence on habitat management. They can also support their local wildlife trust or conservation organization.
Well, thanks very much, Richard, for this unique audio tour, and good luck with the CD. I hope you find lots of listeners.
Thank you very much indeed. Goodbye.
We reached Richard Raft in London. Vanishing Wildlife, the CD, is available from the British Library Bookshop and also from the library's online bookstore at www.bl.uk. And that's it for this week's edition of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you can find in the April 22nd edition of New Scientist magazine. Also in this week's issue, Fear Factor. Just how bad is acrylamide, and how much of it are we eating? This week, New Scientist takes a special look at the food scare the world forgot. Sting Operation. Forget those Hollywood hunks on CSI. It turns out the real champions at sniffing out crime are a bunch of little black wasps. And Videoactive, a new generation of computer games that does away with the joystick and instead has couch potatoes using, of all things, their own bodies to play the game. All this plus lots more science and technology news, features, and opinion. Remember, only New Scientist brings you the week's best ideas. I'm Bill Oxley. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.
Mission Control. SciPod transmission concluded.